I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. And they also refer to me as the drunken preacher from time to time. And that'll make sense a little bit here in a few minutes. My sobriety date is September the 20th, 2016. I'll just let you know, I was born kind of what I was like before. I was born as an only child in an upper middle class family. So I don't have any stories of abuse. I went to Disney World every summer I can remember. I was spoiled rotten. So I don't have any horror stories, but I believe I had the potential to be an alcoholic from both sides of my family. My dad's side were good, hard drinking Italians from the Pittsburgh area. He had 9 brothers and sisters, and 7 of them died from this disease. On my mom's side, she was not one of us, but her family ran moonshine stills in the mountains of West Virginia, good old Irish. So did I have the genetics or did I drink myself into this? Probably a little bit of both, but it doesn't matter. I'm here today and that's all that matters. I found out something when I was 45 years old that I did not know. My dad had been dead for 15 years when I found this out. But my dad was married previously, before he married my mom. And my dad had an affair and left his first wife and child to get with my mom and then had me. I never knew that. And when I found that out, then all of a sudden I look back on my childhood and the light bulb came on. It was like, now I know why on both sides of the family, I always felt like when I walked into the room, I was always held at kind of an arm's distance. I always felt like conversations hushed. I always felt like I was welcome, but not accepted. I always felt like I was on the outside looking in. Now, this could just been totally just me, something in my head. But I always felt lonely in a crowded room. I always felt like I was trying to work my way into being accepted with other people. I don't know where it came from, and I don't know if that had anything to do with it. I don't know if I was picking. I don't know that I was clairvoyant as a child or intelligent in that way, but all I know is it was something that really shook me when I found that out later on. I do know this. It created a lot of fears in me. As a child and growing up, even as a young man, the fear of being rejected by people, the fear of being abandoned, the fear of not being accepted, the fear of being unloved, the fear of being alone. I didn't realize it was fear at the time. But when I got into recovery and I started doing inventory, I had no idea how afraid I was my entire life. But that fear came out in the form of anger. I got into a lot of fights growing up. You know, on the report card, when I was a kid growing up in school, the report card, I'd have straight A's, but then on one side, they would have one grade was how you behaved, and it was called citizenship. And so I'd have straight A's in all my classes, but citizenship, I'd have C's and D's. And over on the other side, the teacher would have comments and little checkbooks and it or little check marks. And it would always have something like doesn't play well with others, doesn't listen to instructions, lacks respect. And that's kind of where. And so I got into all these fights. And I guess in my mind, what I was thinking was because you're rejecting me, because you're not accepting me and you're really hurting my feelings. And I'm scared. I'm going to whip your ass. That's what it was translating as into. And so now I'm starting to go to the principal's office. In my day, growing up in school, the teacher could whip out a paddle and tan your hide right there in the hallway. And so what that led me to start doing was to isolate. I stopped trying to make friends. I stopped trying to go along with the crowd. And the best place that I found to isolate was in our basement in my house, because my dad, being the good Italian drinker that he was, had a totally full stocked bar that rivaled anything at Fridays, Chili's, Olive Garden. I mean, He got it all at Sears. So it had the wraparound corner. It had the beer tap on the wall, the pop gun. Bottles were three shelves, four bottles deep. If they sold the liquor, he had it. We had the very large 19-inch TV over in the corner, you know, back in the 70s. The fireplace, the recliner, that became my safe haven. That was where I started to kind of dabble here and there and started to experiment and was like a mad scientist, you know, mixing this, that, and the other, and started to kind of feel a certain way. I found that it was safer for me to live in my imaginary world, in my mind, in that basement, than to face my fears in the real world. I can remember serenading the imaginary girlfriend, listening to my records in that basement, rather than ask the girl in school, did you like me? You know, back then you would write the note to the girl, do you like me? Check yes or check no. And I remember getting one back one time that had a third option and it just said other, and it was checked, you know? And so I had these fights. I had the average amount of heartbreaks and rejection, you know, and I grew up, my dad would always do that when I would complain. Has anybody ever seen that? My dad would do that to me. He would say, Jeffrey, you know what that is? And he would say, that's the world's smallest violin playing. My heart bleeds for you. You know, nothing bad ever happened to me. It was nothing unusual. But the bottom line was I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I was irritable, restless, and discontent as a child and didn't even know what that was. And then when you start throwing on things like losing a grandfather at age 4, and I've already got this fear of being abandoned. And then I lost my Uncle Fred as a young child, who was like a second dad to me. Then my own dad had a cancer scare. He had a cancer spot on his back, and they cut a chunk out of his back that was that big around and literally that deep. And we thought he was going to die. And so when you combine all that stuff together, for me, all I remember growing up was this sense of tension in my shoulders and in my stomach, my heart, and my chest, always feeling tight, this sense of nervousness. And it seemed like the only time that I felt any relief from it was those times in the basement, sampling the alcohol and escaping to my imagination. Now, I can tell you the day that the magic happened for me, the last day of school, probably somewhere around seventh grade, I had been bullied all year long by a kid we called Robbie the Beast East. He was in high school. We had to wait after school to catch all the county buses at the same time. And he put gum in my hair. He threw my lunch box. He slapped me. He spit on me. He terrorized me every day after school. He was about 6'6", probably 325 pounds. But the last day of school, I thought, I'm going to get a little revenge. I'd taken it all year long. My plan was, when I saw my bus coming around the drive, right before I would get on the bus, I was just going to walk up to him and haul off and hit him as hard as I possibly could, stun him, jump on the bus, and ride off into the sunset. And as I saw my bus coming up the lane, I timed it out, and I thought, now's my time. And I walked up to Robbie, and I hauled off, and I hit him right between the eyes, and I turned around to go jump on the bus, and it wasn't my bus. And I couldn't get on the bus, and Robbie got up and caught me, and he beat me until he literally couldn't beat me anymore. I had lumps and bumps and blood and snot and mucus coming out of every orifice of my body. He beat me within an inch of my life, it felt like. And then my bus finally came rolling around, and a couple of older kids that rode my bus came over, picked me up off the sidewalk and helped me onto our bus. And they were, you know, trying to help kind of clean me up a little bit. And I'm there trying not to cry, and I'm embarrassed, and I'm humiliated. And, And they looked at me, and I remember their name was Suede and Joey. And they were like, man, you got guts. You know, you're stupid, but you got guts, you know. And they said, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you going to be home? And I'm like, yeah, you know, we don't have school. And they said, are your parents going to be home? I'm like, no, they work. And they're like, we're going to come up to your house tomorrow and we're going to get you high. I didn't even really know what that meant. At that time, the only thing I knew about getting high was what I'd seen on Cheech and Chong movies. That was popular back then, but I had never experimented with that or anything. But I thought, great. And the next day they showed up and I had stolen a bottle of rum from my dad's bar. And so when Suede and Joey showed up, they pulled out this bag of marijuana and put it on the bar. And I pulled out a bottle of rum and these three children. They were a few years older than me, but we were all children. They're rolling joints and they're lighting it up and they're giving it to me and we're cracking the rum and here, hit that. And I'd never done that before and I'd seen it in the movies. And so I know that you're supposed to inhale it and it's burning and that's very unpleasant. I don't like that. And they're giving me the rum and I'm drinking that straight and that's burning in a totally different way. And they keep here, smoke that and drink that and smoke that and drink that. And then all of a sudden it hit. And I could breathe. And I felt it from my head to my toes. And that thing that makes us different from our fellows. It was physical. But there was something that happened on the inside for me at that moment. Because at that moment, I realized that's what my solution was. For all the problems and for all the fears and all the anger and all, everything that I had been struggling with my entire life, I found the solution to all my problems. And I wanted to do it as much as I possibly could. And so from that point on, all through high school, it was fun. It was a party. I got the invitation now to start coming on with all the older kids, because when you have access to the alcohol, you got an open ticket. It's like the golden ticket in Willy Wonka. You get the free pass. You get to go to all the older parties and I'm feeling accepted and I'm laughing and I'm a part of the stories. And sure, they're laughing at me a lot of the times, but I really don't care, because I'm feeling more confident. I'm feeling included. I'm feeling comfortable. I'm a part of. And all through high school, it's just increasing and increasing to the point that by the end of high school and my summer, I'm driving myself and I'm drinking in the mornings and I'm drinking every weekend. And then I'm starting to realize that some of those feelings, the anger and the fear and the guilt, they're starting to creep back in, and the alcohol is really not working like it was at first. And so I start looking for other things to try to fill that void, things like church. You know, I started going to church because I heard that all the pretty girls went to the church youth group. So I started hanging out in a church and doing stuff with them. And I really got into sports. I started really concentrating on football and baseball and started getting some offers there and dabbled a little bit in music. By the time I graduated high school, though, and that summer, the drinking was really starting to get pretty serious. And so by the time I go to college on a partial football scholarship, I've joined a fraternity. I've got a high school sweetheart that everybody thinks that we're probably going to get married. But on the inside, I'm probably the most miserable that I've ever been in my life at that point. And I'm only 19 years old. I'm not even a legal drinking age. And I'm a lush. I'm an alcoholic. And I start to realize that I'm lost. And about that time, the perfect storm starts to hit. The girlfriend that I thought I'm going to marry says, you got to pick me or alcohol. And I said, okay, bye. Have a good life. And then the football team that I felt like I had a brotherhood with, the coach said, since you can't make it to practice and be sober, we're going to have to ask you to leave the football team. So now here my fears of rejection start kicking in. And then the fraternity kicks me out for excessive drinking. Have you ever heard of anything like that in your life? I mean, those knuckleheads needed my GPA to keep them, you know, certified and legal, and they're kicking me out for excessive drinking. And then another close relative dies. All these things are starting to build on me, and something that I didn't think would ever happen started to happen. I started to develop not suicidal thoughts, but I started to develop homicidal thoughts. I had all this rage pent up inside of me, and I felt all this rejection and hurt and in my mind, and probably with the alcohol and all of that, the solution came, maybe you need to start inflicting pain yourself. Maybe that'll ease up some of yours. And one night at a bar, some guy just happened to treat me rudely. It wasn't anything more than just stepping on my shoe and not acknowledging it. And I waited for him in an alley after the bar closed. I'm not going to say that I had flashbacks of Robbie the Beast East, but it was about something similar. I caught him when he wasn't looking, and I beat him until I didn't have any more in me. And when I walked away, I honestly didn't know if he was alive or dead. And there was a little sis in our fraternity, and she knew how badly I was struggling, and she found out what had happened, and she came by my dorm room, and she picked me up, and she told me we were going to lunch, and instead she took me to my dad's office because he worked there at the university, and she said, "You're either going to tell him or I am." And she walked me in his office, and I sat down, and I had to tell my dad what my life was. And he checked me out of Eastern Kentucky University, and he took me home, and they packed a bag, and they took me to Lexington, Kentucky, and they checked me into a rehab called Charter Ridge, and I was there for 6 weeks. And while I was at Charter Ridge, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they took us to meetings, and I picked up my first white chip, and I got a temporary sponsor while I was there in treatment. They gave me a third edition big book, because this was, I think, 1989, and I wish I would have gotten the program then. I'd be sitting on 30 something years of sobriety, and who knows what my life would be today, but that's not my story. When I got out of treatment, my sponsor said, "We're going to do a social experiment. I'm going to have all my sponsees. We're going to go to the Ramada Inn in Lexington, and we're going to go out and we're going to dance with girls, and we're going to prove that we can have a good time without alcohol." And I said, "All right, I'm game." And we all met at the Ramada Inn. And by the end of the evening, we had to drive our sponsor home because he was drunker than Cootie Brown. And that night I decided AA is definitely not going to work. No, it's not for me. And the next night I was back drinking again. And that's when the suicidal thoughts started to come. That's when I realized that I was lost and I had no solution, no answer. And so it was a Saturday night, probably about 10 o'clock. And my plan was I was going to leave my house. I was going to drink as much as I could. And I was going to drive about 25 miles to the east of my house, where there was a long, long hill and a sharp curve in the road, and I was just going to get the car up to about 80 miles an hour and just let go of the wheel and let the car just go right off the edge of the cliff. And that was my plan, and I took off with that plan in mind, and I blacked out. And I did come to. I didn't drive off into oblivion. I woke up out of the blackout the next morning on Sunday morning at 11:05, about 45 miles to the west, sitting in a church parking lot. You know what happens at 11:05 on a Sunday morning at a church? It was the same church that I had been looking for a girlfriend for, you know, the year before. How I got there, I have no idea. That was not a thought in my mind. It was God's hand. And I went on in, and I don't understand. I don't remember the message or anything. All I remember is sitting down, and remember at the end, they said, "If you've tried everything else, but you've not given God a shot, why don't you give him a shot today?" And that's what I did. And I went from the bar room to a Bible college. I had a spiritual experience that day, and I'm not going to go that route with my story because there's a lot more to it than that, but I will tell you this, that was a day that I had a spiritual experience, And I gave God my life at that day, and I'm in it 100%. And I really did go to Bible college, and I became a minister. And while I was at the Bible college, I found my wife and I got married and we started having kids, and I started in ministry, and it was a very successful career while it lasted. But it reminds me, you remember in the Big Book chapter 3, page 32, it tells a story about a certain businessman that saw that he couldn't get anywhere if he was drunk. And it said that he remained bone dry for 25 years. And then after a successful career, he thought that the long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink again, and that he went back to drinking. And then 4 years later, he was dead. That was almost my story. See, I knew that I couldn't be a minister and drink. At least I didn't think that I could. And the woman that I married, I didn't think I could stay married to her and drink, at least not the way I was drinking. And so at that time, I thought that I had enough self-discipline and enough good reason to not drink. And I didn't for 10 years, not through AA or anything else. I just didn't drink for 10 years. And as long as I stayed away from the drink, it was fundamental. Ministry took the place of alcohol, and it worked until it didn't. But the problem was, is that ministry didn't replace God. I still didn't have God in my life the way I needed him in my life to keep me sober. And so in 1999, the perfect storm happened. In June, my grandmother died. She was probably the only one in both sides of the family that really accepted me for who I was with that dark story. You know, I wasn't this dark child from an adulterous affair. I was just Jeffrey. She died in June. And in July, a baby in our church that was 2 years old, that it had cancer, she suffered with it for 2 years, died. And I had to do the funeral and try to pastor to the family. And now I'm struggling with God myself. In July, a 16-year-old kid sat down in his backyard and took a shotgun and blew his head off. And it kind of flashed me back to my past. And now I'm struggling even more. And in September, my dad dies of a sudden stroke. And what I didn't tell you is that when I became a pastor, there for about 3 years, my dad and I didn't speak, because he didn't understand why I wanted to be a pastor. I was all set up on another profession. He didn't like the fact that I was going to be a pastor, and we were estranged for about 3 years. But then later on, we worked all that out and we became best friends. He was my best friend. We talked to each other every day on the phone almost. And like that, he was gone. And I was angry at God. And my heart is broken. And I feel abandoned, and I feel stressed, and I feel angry, and I feel confused, and I need relief. And I heard the thought in my brain say, it's been 10 years. Surely you won't drink like that now. And I took a drink. I didn't set out to drink like an alcoholic. I just set out to have a drink. And within a matter of days, I was drinking like I was at age 19, right before I had to go back to treatment. It was 16 years before that I had walked into the rooms of AA. And what was it like while I was out there during that 16 years? I mean, it was 16 years before I would get back into the rooms of AA. What was it like during that time? I was obsessed with the alcohol. I drank to feel normal, not better. I drank when I was happy. I drank when I was sad. I drank when I was bored. I drank for any and every reason under the sun. I just drank just to function. I drank to hide and calm the voices in my head and the nerves and the emotions. And even if I swore I was only going to drink one, it always led to two and three and four and on to oblivion. And I, even though I thought I was managing my life because I was paying the bills and putting clothes on the kids and food in the house and to going on vacations and cars in the garage, the real truth of the matter was I was not able to manage my life because I couldn't walk out my front door without drinking. I couldn't do the stuff to pay for all that stuff without drinking. And I'd go to any length to drink, and I'd go to any length to hide it. You know, when you're a preacher, you just can't go to the local liquor store. You can't let people see you. So that means you got to drive to the next town or the town two towns over. And then you can't keep going back to the same store every day. So now you got to start doing the circle. You have any idea how many miles I put on my car and my truck just so that I wouldn't give people the impression that I'm an alcoholic? And it came before all else, came before job, family, wife, kids. I drank first because I wanted to, then I drank because I needed to, and then I ended up drinking because I had to. And when I look back on my life now, then I can see that I was absolutely consumed with selfishness because I wanted to control everyone and everything just so I could do what I wanted to do, and that was drink. And if I couldn't control everybody, then that's how I dealt with it, was to drink. And so what happened? I mean, what led me to get sober, and how did I get sober? Well, it started off with pain and consequences, but later on it became a matter of I was either going to get sober or die. The consequences really started with my family. It was loneliness. You know, when I'm isolating and I'm trying to hide the drinking, I'm putting up walls, I'm lying, I'm sneaking. And I've got my mom left. I've got my wife left. I've got my kids left. I've got a few close friends that know what I'm living this double life, right? But when I'm doing that, what I'm really doing is I'm sending the message to every one of those people. And the message, I didn't realize that until I got into recovery and started to work through it. The message I'm sending to them is, I want nothing to do with you. I'm drinking because of you. Your love is not strong enough to keep me sober. You're not worth me quitting. I don't love you enough to sober up. Then they're feeling guilty. Then they're pulling away. They're starting to pull away from me. Then that's giving into my fear of abandonment and my fear of rejection. And what am I doing? I'm pulling away further and treating it the only way I know how. And I'm drinking on top of that. And it, that vicious cycle. And so I am tearing families apart, my family. I'm tearing their hearts apart. Then I start having consequences in my career. I start losing ministries. It's hard for preachers to keep a job when they're drinking the way I was drinking. It just happens. The first ministry I lost was in Bristol, Tennessee. It started off little. You know, I can remember going to a funeral visitation and people started to raise the eyebrow. Like when you go to a funeral visitation and you make your way finally to the front to express your sympathies to the family, and you're so drunk that you fall over and you take out one of the family members, about four flower arrangements, and almost the coffin that's open, you know? And you blame it on the flip-flops that you're wearing because you didn't even have the common sense to change and wear appropriate clothes, right? I remember doing a funeral there in Bristol, and I did the funeral at the funeral home, and I'm leading us out to the cemetery to do the graveside at the end. And I'm the lead car. I leave the funeral home and I'm the lead car. There's probably 25 to 30 cars following my car. And I'm so drunk, I'm going to the wrong cemetery. And I get lost and I end up leading the entire funeral procession through one of those self-serve car washes, through one of the bays. People start talking about those things. You know, and so Bristol Church ends up saying, look, dude, you got to go. You know, we love you. The church is growing and all that, but you got to find another church. So I go to Paoli, Indiana. It starts there, too. Kind of small at first. Things like, you know, you're doing a wedding and you're doing the vows and you tell the groom to make the promise to love. And instead of saying his bride, you're telling him to say his ex-wife's name, you know, like three times in the same ceremony. You know, people start talking, but I've got a tattoo. This happened in Paoli, and I don't know if anybody can see that. I know you can't see what the actual tattoo is, but it's a double yoke. That's what they use two oxen to plow a field with. In Matthew 11:29 says, Jesus says, take my yoke upon you, for my burden is easy. And it's about, basically, it's about doing life with Jesus, right? So people look at that tattoo and they go, oh, that's a great religious man. That's a great tattoo. He's really preaching a message with that. Well, the story behind that is, though, that was my first DUI, the day I got my first DUI. Yeah, a friend called me in Bloomington, Indiana, and said, I'm getting a tattoo. You want to come up and get one? I said, heck yeah, that sounds good. And so I'm drinking on the way up. We're there at the tattoo parlor, and we're both drinking. They're getting a tattoo. And then the tattoo artist says, I don't take cards. I only take cash. He said, but there's an ATM right around the corner. And I leave to literally go around the corner to the ATM to get a couple hundred dollars of cash and come right back. Well, as soon as I leave to go around the corner, I black out. And I guess according to the police reports, then that's all what I have to go by. I hit a parked car on the street. I pull into a tire center because I blow out my tire. I get my tire fixed. And instead of just coming back around the corner, I end up in a county 45 miles away in Brown County, Indiana. I end up wrecking my car in a ditch. By the way, this is all on my wife's birthday, which we're supposed to have dinner that night, right? And so I end up in jail, and instead I'm calling my wife from the sheriff's phone and telling her, yeah, the car's totaled. I'm not coming home for your birthday. But by the way, I've got a great new tattoo, you know, and a DUI. And yeah, that ministry didn't work out either. So before I get the next ministry, we find out that my wife has cancer. Stage 4, liver cancer. They give her 3 months to live. The next 2 years is a blur. She made it about 9 months and she dies. And my drinking is off the scale. After she's been gone for about a year and a half, I ended up remarrying. I've got a church in Harlan, Kentucky. My new wife, she knows that I drink some. She just has no idea the level that I drink. And she's okay with it because she doesn't know. But I get another DUI. And the gig is up because now the church knows. But instead of firing me, the church says, if you'll get into recovery, we'll let you keep your job. And that's how I came to AA. I walked into the rooms of AA 26 years after I left the rooms of AA and picked up my second white chip. And I was tired. I was tired of lying. I was tired of the damage. I was tired of the cycles. And I wanted to keep my job. I wanted to keep my wife. I wanted to keep my home. I wanted to keep my kids. And I said, all right, I'll do it. I'll do it. And that's how I got sober. I started going to meetings and I got a sponsor. And he started taking me through the steps. And all went well for a time. And my sponsor got me right into service work. My first service job in the AA in Harlan was to clean ashtrays. You can go to Harlan, Kentucky today, and there's still 4 smoking meetings a week in Harlan, Kentucky. And I was cleaning those ashtrays for 2 months. I cleaned those stupid ashtrays, right? And then I graduated to making coffee. I didn't even drink coffee before I came to AA, let alone know how to make coffee. The first meeting I made coffee for, people were spitting it out and gagging and coughing. And they said, who made the coffee? And I said, I did. And they said, how much coffee did you put in it? And I said, man, I filled it up. What are you supposed to do? You know, but he taught me. He was teaching me how to do all of this stuff. We were reading through the book. You know, he was teaching me about service work and about prayer and about he had me going with him to do H&I. And after probably close to a year of sobriety, oh, my goodness, they elected me the alternate GSR. Oh, I had arrived. I'm going up to treatment centers and I'm teaching classes and I'm starting noontime meetings. I was Mr. AA. I mean, I thought I had it, the tiger by the tail. I was the ex-drunk preacher. I could hold my head up high all through town. I didn't have to lie about it. Everybody was relieved. Everybody was happy. I was doing the deal for a while. And the book says that we have a foe that is subtle and that it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And at some point, I started resting on my laurels. And at some point, I stopped doing steps 2 through 11. I could go to a meeting and say, I'm Jeff, I'm an alcoholic, and I could tell you about what you ought to do for recovery. But I had absolutely no program. I didn't have a relationship with God. And there was nothing drastic that happened. There was no tragedy. I don't know whether I got bored. I don't know whether I got cocky. I don't know whether I got arrogant. But the book tells us that lack of power, that's our dilemma. And evidently, one day I decided that I had power over it, and I thought that I would be able to do it. And the day came, and I took a drink. With 13 months sobriety, I took a drink. And as soon as I did it, I was scared to death. Scared to death that I was going to lose my family, my wife, my kids, my grandkids that were on the way, everything. And so I tried to lie and hide it and tried to stop, but I couldn't stop. And I kept drinking for 5 months, going to meetings, trying to live the lie. And it all came crashing down. September the 19th, 2016, I went to my son's JV football game, and I'd been drinking the whole day. Was trying to come back to Kingsport to go back to the house here in Kingsport. Tapped a car on Stone Drive, one of the main streets there in town, and got my third DUI. And while I'm sitting in jail, I'm thinking, it's over. Not only am I going to lose this job, but I've probably lost my career. This is the third strike in ministry. You're probably not going to do that anymore. This woman is not going to stay married to me. My kids are probably done with me. I'm going to have nowhere to go, nothing to do. All those fears about rejection and abandonment, all these are going to come true. And as I said in that jail cell, I said, the only thing I probably need to do is get out of this jail cell, get my keys, drive back to Harlan, go into the parsonage and get my 45 out of the nightstand and just end it all. And that's what I was planning on doing. And when my wife bailed me out the next morning, she'd already taken her wedding ring off. She said, I can't do this. My youngest son, who was still living with us there at the house, and he'd already packed his stuff and ran away to Cincinnati to his older brother's house. He didn't want anything to do with me. And I took my ring off and gave it to my wife and said, here, get what you can out of it. Just give me my keys. I won't bother you anymore. And instead, she heard something in my voice. She wouldn't give me my keys. Instead, she put me in her car and she took me to Woodridge, which is our local nut house and detox center. And she walked me in and she said, here, and just left me there. And while I'm there on suicide watch, the church calls and says, yeah, you're fired. And my kids call and say, we're done. Never want to see you again. Don't show up at the hospital when your grandkids are born. You'll be arrested. And I'm sitting there in Woodridge, absolutely, totally destroyed. Nothing, no one, nothing. And for the first time, maybe the real reality set in that maybe I need to do this for me. And so I made a commitment and I cried out to God for help. And about 2 days later, they came and said, you got a visitor in the family room. And I walked out and there was my wife, and she'd put her ring back on. And she said, if you promise me that you will honestly try, we'll do this again. And the people at Woodridge said, we're going to try to get you into a rehab down in Nashville called Cumberland Heights. And they said, we're full up. We don't have any room. And they said, okay. And they tried to get me a place in Georgetown, Kentucky. And they said, all right, as soon as you get out of Woodridge, come on up. And so that's what we did. And we're on the road. We're driving over the mountain to this place. And I'm on the phone with them. And I start to realize, hey, this is not a treatment center. This is just intensive outpatient. This is just an IOP center. And while I'm on the phone with them, I get a phone call coming in. I look and it's a Nashville number. And I said, hold on just a minute. And I click over to the other line and it's Cumberland Heights in Nashville, the treatment center that we couldn't get into. And they said, listen, we reviewed your case. And because you had a year of sobriety and had worked the steps, we have a special relapse unit. Can you be here tomorrow? I said, you bet your ass I can. They said, we'll see you tomorrow. So I drove myself to Nashville. And I got to spend 30 days in that treatment facility. and it saved my life. And I came back to Kingsport and I found a home group and a new sponsor. And I picked up my third and hopefully my final white chip. I don't ever want to do this again. What am I like today as a result of all of that? I can tell you that as far as the drink goes, the obsession's been lifted and I'm no longer a slave to alcohol. I still have the thought from time to time, but just like the book says, I recoil from it just like a hot flame in a moth. And I've reached a position of neutrality to where I can even be around it with family members and ball games as long as I'm spiritually fit and I've got a good reason to be there. But you know what? I've recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And as far as my family goes, this past month, my wife and I celebrated 9 years of marriage. My kids' relationships and I have been restored. I've got 4 grandbabies now, a 5th one on the way, and they even bring them and drop them off at my house for a week at a time sometimes. I'm a football dad. I'm a soccer dad. I'm a chef. I'm a banker. In other words, I'm right in the middle of the family. I'm not on the outside looking in. I'm the one they call for advice. I'm a referee when they're fighting. I'm a shoulder for them to cry on. And it's as far as my job and career, it's been 6.5 years. And no, I'm not back in the church. But, you know, I worked in a call center for a little bit, and then I worked in a cigar shop for a little bit. And I even tried to teach English to Chinese kids online for a little bit. But a couple of years ago, my sponsor suggested I might look into being a certified peer recovery specialist. And I ended up getting a job as a coordinator for the Sullivan County Anti-Drug Coalition. And do you want to know what I do? I basically use all the skills that I had in ministry and all the things that I've learned in recovery, and they fit together. I couldn't have asked for a better job. I couldn't have asked God to use me in a better way today than what He's doing. And it didn't happen overnight, but it's the result of these 12 steps. And I try to work them every single day. It's about really honestly trying to live steps 1 through 12 on a daily basis. I have to be honest every morning when I get up. I know who I am and what I am. And I know that God is the only way that I can do this. And I do that in step 2 every morning. And I try to turn that day over to Him every single morning before I ever leave the house and say, I got to quit playing God. I got to quit being selfish and I need your help to do it. And I take that third step prayer every single day. And throughout my day, I'm looking for those character defects because I am not perfect by any means. And when I see them come up, instead of blaming you for those character defects, I'm taking a closer look at me and then I'm calling my sponsor or some other person in the program and I'm saying, here's what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? And then I'm reaching out to God and asking His help for it. So I'm doing 4, 5, 6, and 7. And if I owe amends, I'm following up with 8 and 9. And all day long, as it's happening, I'm doing that 10th step. So that when I lay my head on a pillow at night on step 11, I can review my day. And when that next day starts, I'm going to God right off the bat and asking Him to get involved. And all of that helps me do that 12th step. It helps me work with others. It helps me do things like this. It helps me make coffee. And I'm not choking people today when I make coffee. You know, I learned how to make the coffee. I set up chairs. I chair meetings. I go into treatment centers. I go into sober living houses. But more importantly, like page 19 says, I get to practice these things in my home and at my job and in the world. That's the more important practice of these principles. And now, do I still have fear and anger and impatience and still try to control the show at times? Yeah, I still do. But that's why I still need to have God every day and why this is one day at a time for me. It's progress, not perfection. But I am making progress. But I've learned this. As long as I'm living in the solution, life is manageable and life is sweet. I'll give you a real quick thing, and I know we're just about out of time, so I'll give you a real quick picture of what it looks like for me. It's probably been about 3 or 4 years ago how this all kind of showed how the steps work for me today. Our kids love fruit, and peaches is one of their favorite things, and we have a lot of, especially this time of year and during the summer, we have a lot of roadside farmers bring in peaches, and my wife will buy them by the bushel. And we'll put them in a fruit bowl on the counter And right below the counter is the trash can. And all the peaches have the little stickers on them. And so all you have to do is take the peach out of the bowl and take the sticker off and put it in the trash can. But our kids are physically and mentally and spiritually incapable of taking the sticker off the peach and putting it in the trash can. They have the ability, though, to take the sticker off the peach and put it on the counter and put it on the tile and put it on the lid to the trash can. But they don't have the ability to put it in the trash can. And it drives me insane. And so I tried being nice to control. And then I tried being ugly to try to control them. I even tried to take the stickers when I peeled it off the counter and put it on their little computer monitor so that when they play their video games, they see the sticker to remind them. Then they tell their mother, and then their mother and I get in a fight. And then one day I actually made the bold proclamation, listen, there will be no more peaches allowed in this house anymore, right? Until finally one day I call my sponsor. And I'm explaining the saga of the peach stickers and how I'm losing my mind. And I can't believe it, but I'm actually thinking about taking a drink over peach stickers, right? And he asked me the question that he always asked me. At what point have you left God out of this? And I'm like, I guess back at the produce stand, Daryl. I don't know. All I know is that I'm mad and I'm pissed off and I don't know what to do about it. And he's, have you inventoried this? No, call me when you inventory it. So I sit down and I put it pen to paper. And you know what I found out? It had nothing to do with the peach stickers. It had to do with my fear of rejection. It had, see, these are stepkids. It had to deal with my pride and my ego and being disrespected and my fear of them not loving me and not accepting me. And when I started looking at my part and all the things that I had done to pour gas on this situation and the amends that I needed to make. And then when I called him back and he said, now, are you ready to start praying about this? And I took it to my higher power in prayer. And I said, God, take these feelings from me and give me an intuitive thought. But for the first time, instead of praying, God changed them. And I started saying, God, give me an intuitive thought of what I can do in this situation to resolve this. And then I heard it. You know what he said? Why don't you take the stickers off the peaches before you put them in the bowl? What? Isn't it great how this program works? I'm a miracle today. That's the way I see it. And I see a bunch of miracles in front of me. You know, I was in a meeting and I close with this. I was in a meeting and we were talking about the miracles and someone made the comment, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens. And they caught me after the meeting and they said, you really still believe in miracles today? I mean, you really believe in miracles like Jesus turning water into wine? And I said, well, I can tell you this much for sure. At my house, Jesus turned Jim Beam into black coffee. So, yeah, don't leave before the miracle happens. I'm Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share.